You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko justu mōntoku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Rātū Tuesday, the 27th of August. My name is Justin, and I'm stepping in for Olivia, who is away for this week, but I still have Oscar Perez as my right-hand man today. How
indeed.
Are you, mate?
Not too bad, just ticking along. Yourself?
I'm good. Any good thing on the news for you this week?
There's been a relatively big week internationally. Lots of mm-hmm. things going on. Not to of say course. It hasn't been a big week nationally either so far. Lots of announcements, a few that will be covered later in the show today.
Of course.
Around trains, etc. So stay tuned for that. Big mental health announcements as well.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a few things here and there as well that have caught my eye. Anything in particular for you?
Mostly international-wise, because, as you know, we have the G7 summit in France and, of course, the Amazon fire.
Indeed.
But, yeah, but we don't want to spoil anything first, do
indeed.
We?
No,
yeah.
No. So what is on the show?
And we on the show today, I talked to Hamilton Mayor Andrew King about the new Hamilton to Auckland rail link. Oscar talks to Green MP Chloe Swarbrick about PIKI, a mental health pilot program. International Desk goes to Brazil to look at the politics behind the fires at the Amazon. And finally, on Green Desk, our Green Desk man, Mitch, talks to Environment Minister David Parker on soil quality. Hey, aha, Ovocado, get in touch with us with any thoughts you have. Let's say on mental health, on the green issues, or the rail, or even anything international-wise. Tuku patu he mai, you can text us on 5395, or why am I? Call us in the studio on 309-3879. And we also have a Twitter account at 95BFN News, and we now have an Instagram account,
indeed.
I believe.
You can contact us on all those socials as well, 95BFM News. If you have any comments or ideas for us in the upcoming weeks or throughout the show.
Yes, and let's get into the show.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
The government has announced last week that it has approved funding for a new rail service from Hamilton to Auckland. The service will start at Frankton Station in Hamilton and end at Papakura, and it will have two return services each weekday and one return service on Saturday. I spoke with Hamilton Mayor Andrew King about this, and I first asked, what is the purpose of this rail?
To give people another option for transport, to look after the environment and to actually let people get into Auckland to do business, or people from Auckland to come into Hamilton to do business in a way where they're not flustered and where they haven't been sitting in traffic for 2 hours to get here.
The train will be taking around about 300 people a day up and down, and it'll mean that people can leave early in the morning, they can get up into Auckland. They can connect and do business, but not be stressed before they get there.
Will it also, on the public sector, create more jobs for the city itself?
Yes, well, this is the start. This is the beginning of a journey. This is the beginning of a process. It's cost a lot of money to be put into this. It's been done properly. And as we improve the service may increase in frequency. The length of the train can be increased, and it's a start of another form of transport that Hamilton hasn't had for a long time.
And benefits-wise, do you think it'll be more beneficial to Hamilton more than Auckland?
I think it'll be a benefit both ways. I mean, we've got people who are going to Auckland to work. They'll be putting into the Auckland economy, and you've got that money coming back into the Hamilton economy. So I think it's a benefit for both Auckland and for Hamilton. So mm-hmm. There'll also be people coming from Auckland back into Hamilton as well, once the service really increases in frequency.
Will this rail going to improve the tourism industry in Hamilton?
No, it's not aimed at the tourists, it's aimed at the business person at this stage.
Right.
But if it increases in frequency, then yes, it may well be more inclusive for tourists and recreational users and other people.
Now we're on the question of frequency. We all know the proposed service will only have two services every weekday. Why is that?
Because at this is the beginning of a service. This is just the start of the process. So as time goes forward and the money's been spent on the infrastructure, on the trains, on the carriages, so as the demand grows, the service frequency will grow as well.
Do you think right now only two services per weekday is enough?
Yes, we think that's enough to get started. I mean, the concept of the train at this stage is to get people from Hamilton to Auckland in the morning and get them back at night. But the money's been spent, the trains, the rolling stock are there, so that as that increases and we get a service going back and forward, that will happen as the demand increases.
Will the trains be more frequent in the future?
Well, we don't know until we get the service going, two trains going up in the morning, two trains coming back at night. So as I say, as the demand increases, we'll look at that then.
Would you like to see the service expand further, let's say up to Auckland City Centre or down south all the way to Wellington?
Well, look, at this stage, where the population base is in Auckland with 1.5 million people and in Hamilton with 170,000 people and the Greater Waikato having 500,000 people. So we think at this stage getting the service going between Hamilton and Auckland is remarkable and we're very pleased with that. We haven't started to think about trains going further afield at this stage.
What do you think? Do you want to see an expanded service from your own point of view?
No, not at this stage. I think running a train at the speed that our train is running between Hamilton heading south to Wellington is more of a tourist venture at this stage. The trains and the lines and stuff aren't good enough to run a fast service. And if it was aimed at the business markets, I don't think it would work
right
at this stage. But in time, if a very fast train went in the future, like we're seeing in Asia, with of course that may change. But we have in New Zealand with their topography, we have planes that do that type of service, and they do it very well.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one. They shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
And that was Hamilton Mayor Andrew King, and the new rail service is going to be launched mid-2020. Kei te whakarongo koe, ki te waia marunga BFM. You are listening to The Wire on 95BFM, and remember, you can text us your thoughts on this story or any other stuff on 305395 or YMI. Give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. And for now, here's Millennia from Mermaidens.
Yourself with everyone. rangi marie o rangi nui e tui honei o papu tuanuku e takatonei o te taia e afinei I a tātou tihei mauri ora. This is The Green Desk on 95BFM.
Yes, this week on Green Desk, Mitch had a korero with Environment Minister David Parker about the new national policy statement for highly productive land. This new policy statement aims to tighten the management on highly productive land under the Resource Management Act in order to protect these areas from arable land from inappropriate subdivision and urban development. And they discussed what will be included in the policy statement and how it will be implemented at ground level. Mitch begins by asking Minister Parker for a bit of context on the issue and why there is a necessity for such legislation.
Well, we know that in recent decades we've lost many thousands of hectares of our highly productive soils to both intensive subdivisions but also to lifestyle blocks that prevent them being used for, you know, horticulture. And so we need to make sure that as our population grows and we need more housing, which we clearly do, we're not doing it on top of our most productive soils.
Is the majority of this land that is considered highly productive all around pretty much urban developments?
A lot of it is, partly because towns and cities were originally built close to where people could grow their food. And cities have expanded. There's a risk that if you don't protect these areas, they expand over those areas rather than around them. Some of these are really important. You know, for example, most of the South Island can't grow leafy green vegetables in winter because it's too cold. Some of the soils around south of Auckland in the Pukekohe region are used to grow our broccoli and our other leafy greens in winter and then are shipped throughout the country. So, you know, we need to house people, but we need to feed them as well. So we've got to be careful that we don't have housing and lifestyle blocks on top of these precious soils.
Is maybe some of the reason why it's only occurring around the urban areas, apart from them being close to fertile soils, due to like some of our farming practices, which have, you know, made our land less arable?
There are some problems with soil quality as well that were identified in the Environment Aotearoa report that came out last year. It showed that some of our soils have been compacted by intensive use with heavy animals trampling the soils and squeezing out the gaps between the soil particles, which means they can't store as much water. The little microbiological communities that live in the soils are adversely impacted. And so, yeah, we also need to have a look at land use practices. Of course, we've also got to combat erosion. We're losing a lot of soils into our waterways. That's not done through the NPS on soil protection. That's done through the water NPS that's coming.
Right, and so when we're starting to talk about impacts of urban development, erosion into freshwater and soil, they're all obviously got their own documents, but are they being developed together in a more of an integrated way than they have been before?
Yes, they are. For example, we launched the National Policy Statement to protect highly productive soils the week before we announced our revised National Policy Statement on urban development so that we could make sure that whilst we meet the needs of the population, you know, we've got people sleeping in the streets in New Zealand because we haven't got enough housing. That doesn't mean to say that housing should just go on all this wonderful flat land that is sometimes our most highly productive soil. We can, if we plan properly, meet both of these objectives.
For the soil quality statement, what are we actually proposing here?
The first stage of it is requiring councils to identify their Class 1, 2 and 3 soils. They make about 40%, 14% of New Zealand's land area at the moment, and our best soils, our Class 1 and 2 soils, are only 5%. So councils will be required to map those areas and to be careful that they don't allow them to be unnecessarily built upon. Most of the time there are alternatives. There might be the occasional pocket that's already surrounded by urban areas that they still choose to develop into housing, but by and large these areas are going to be protected better in the future.
How is this actually going to be translated into protection? Because I don't know, in a lot of district plans and statements that I've experienced with, you know, the words protect from inappropriate subdivision and land use and development, they're already all throughout our, you know, statutory documents. So I'm wondering, how is this new policy statement going to ensure that that is carried out at a lot by lot or a development level?
Because it elevates in the hierarchy of things that the councils have to give effect to. So it's effectively a national direction coming down from on high, requiring them to better protect those soils. It's given effect through change next time they change their plans, or they've got an application for a plan change to change land use. They have to accord more weight protection of those highly productive lands. And although plan changes take a bit of time, it will also have immediate effect in respect of proposed changes of land use, which generally aren't permitted activities. It's generally not a permitted activity to change a piece of rural land into a subdivision. And so as part of the consent process, this would be taken into account as well.
A lot of my experiences as a planner myself is mitigation for these things. And so I want to know, is the new document, is it going to be setting bottom lines, or is, you know, mitigation going to prevail again?
Well, it requires the council to better protect highly productive soil. So if they just tried to carry on as they were, they would be in breach of the national direction. We would pick that up partly through the reporting obligations that councils have to the Ministry for the Environment, and we'd be holding them to account if they weren't doing it. I don't expect that to be a problem. I've had quite a bit of contact from councillors to say that they've always been worried about this, but they find it quite hard to resist the power of the people who are trying to, you know, turn a piece of land that might be worth $20,000 or $30,000 a hectare into worth many hundreds of thousands of a hectare as subdivided land. And this will help them resist those pressures.
What are we talking about here in terms of submissions? They're obviously open at the moment. When do they shut?
I think they sit shut by the end of October, I think it's from memory, but 8 weeks in total, so yeah, they'd be right, end of October.
Cool.
And thereafter we'll analyse the submissions and then make any modifications that are necessary, and then the document's promulgated by way of a statutory regulation which gives effect to it.
Right, and what do you think people should be, you know, saying in these submissions?
Well, I think they should be saying that they want to protect our ability for future generations to grow food. But maybe we've been a bit slack in New Zealand to take these things for granted, because relative to a lot of other countries, we've got a lot of these high-value soils compared with our population. But nonetheless, we can't afford to lose them. They're really precious to feed not just ourselves, but, you know, to export food to the rest of the world and, you know, pay for the things that we like to import.
Awesome. Well, thank you for that, David. I think it's about all the questions I've got. Did you want to add anything else yourself?
Just to emphasise that it's not just about intensive subdivisions. Lifestyle blocks really intrude into these areas and make it difficult for them to be used for horticultural production as well. So we're looking at both of those things.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihei Modi Ora.
And that was Mitch talking to Environment Minister David Parker. Submissions for the policy statement close on the 10th of October, so make sure you get your voice heard so we can help protect the land which is most at risk. You, kei te whakarongo koe ki te Waia Marunga BFM. You're on The Wire on 95 BFM, and we are going to take a quick break.
Are you a dick?
Nah.
Do you like yummy food?
Oh, yeah.
Well then, what's for dinner tonight?
Well, I was thinking...
Wrong! What you need is a Lucky Taco Fiesta Kit. Everything you need to make Lucky Tacos at home in just 10 minutes. Tasty, spicy, fresh, Lucky Tacos make you feel good. And with free delivery in Auckland, why not make it a ritual? Pick up a Lucky Taco Fiesta Kit at your local Faro Fresh, or get free delivery direct from the HQ at theluckytaco.co.nz.
What an occasion. My friends, the music, the atmosphere. You know what I could go for? An interesting cocktail.
Liquor King Delivery. Everything you need for an interesting cocktail delivered to your door.
Hot dog!
Discover interesting cocktails and more at Liquor King. More than your average bottle store, Liquor King has that little something extra. And now there's free delivery on any order with code BFM. That's free delivery with code BFM. Liquor King. Go to lk.co.nz. Terms and conditions apply.
Biscuits and fresh vegetables every Tuesday from 7 p.m. Replayed 4 a.m. Wednesday, and always online at 95bfm.com. Check it.
Stinky Jim. Stinky Groove. Stinky Jim. Stinky Groove. Stinky Jim. Stinky Groove. Stinky. Stinky.
Stinky Jim. He stinks from within.
Thanks to the Lee Sawmill Cafe.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. And Oscar, I believe you have a story on mental health.
I do indeed. So Friday, the 23rd of August, marked the expansion of the Youth Mental Health Pilot Program, PIKI, into the Wairarapa DHB region, which extended it further into the Wellington area. It already existed and started in the Porirua region and is slowly making its way out into the area with aims to reach the whole country at the end of the pilot program. I was lucky enough to speak to Chloe Swarbrick of the Green Party earlier today about the expansion of the PIKI program, and I started by asking her whether she could bring us back up to speed with what the PIKI program actually entailed.
Within the Green Labour Confidence and Supply Agreement, which was the commitment formed, negotiated to help form this government, we got a commitment to providing free, accessible mental health services to 18 to 25-year-olds and accessible and affordable mental health services to all New Zealanders, which is obviously reflected in the $1.9 billion budget bid that just went through a few months ago. So the PIKI program, or pilot rather, is a really core component of moving towards ensuring that there are those free services available for those under the age of 25, which is when the majority of people who do end up with experiencing mental ill health throughout the rest of their life will start to have those problems surfacing. So it's focused on targeting mild to moderate, because we have a number of services at the moment which work with the more severe end of things. But what you'll typically hear on the ground out talking to folks, and particularly rangatahi young people in this country, is that there's not often anywhere to turn if you're not quite sure that you're up to the level that you should be to be accessing help, whether it's through a GP or otherwise. So the whole point of PIKI is that it's supposed to be a one-stop shop. Any door is the right door. You go to the website and you can self-refer, you can call the phone number, you can go to your GP or your nurse, and or even if you're still at school or at university or at a polytech, through any institution that is hooked in with the DHBs, and they will put you on a path of referral. And the point is to have a ton of different solutions for people. So for some people, they will need that face-to-face counselling, and that's totally cool and fine and will be on offer for people. For others, it will be more peer support. And that's what's really cool and innovative about the PIKI program, is that we have trained up a bunch of younger people with lived experience who are all being paid the living wage, I would note, was an important part of the negotiation. And these peer support workers obviously typically seen as a way to have those conversations that may not be seen as intense or intimidating as it is to go into a room by yourself and sit down on a chair and talk to a quote-unquote professional, but to talk to somebody who's already been through it themselves. So this PIKI program, as of yesterday, is now officially rolled out within the Greater Wellington region. Our first point of rollout was Porirua, and yesterday we finished with the Hut. That encompasses three different DHBs. The point of this pilot project is to make sure that it is actually effective and culturally appropriate, that being culturally appropriate for the diversity within Aotearoa New Zealand, but obviously also in this context within Greater Wellington. And moving forward, after a number of evaluations from the University of Otago, we will be, and we are, as the Greens, pushing to continue rolling this out throughout the country, because as we've seen in news particularly of late, there is a huge amount of demand for meaningful mental health services that meet people's needs.
Some people may question what you mean by a culturally appropriate mental health service system. What do you mean, and how important is it, and how do you make a culturally appropriate mental health system for rangatahi at least?
So the most important thing about providing a culturally appropriate mental health service is not one Pākehā politician standing up and saying that this is what I think is required for everybody, whether they are Māori, Pacifica, of Asian, Indian descent, but instead it is about this process, the fancy buzzword that everybody in the DHBs and in the Ministry of Health are using at the moment is COVID-19. But basically it's about walking hand in hand with those affected communities and actually backing the services that have been really effective in affected communities, often working off the back of philanthropy and spending far too much time writing funding grants instead of actually doing the good mahi on the ground for the past several years. So culturally appropriate is basically just about ensuring that it is fit for purpose. So different people in different communities of different backgrounds will require different things and different services. Basically, if you are, for example, attempting to throw somebody from South Auckland into a service that was built for a young person in Christchurch experiencing trauma from the Christchurch earthquakes, then you are going to have probably a result that isn't super perfect because it's not going to be designed with that person and their concerns or their life experience in mind. The whole point of building a service that is culturally appropriate, culture by definition is about a shared set of values, so it's about understanding the context and life experience that young people are coming to this from. And that's the really important thing that we've built into the PICI pilot project, is its ability to shift and change as we do develop that research and that evidence base. But also, obviously, with the likes of those support workers, those peer support workers on the ground, there is the ability to be a lot more flexible than if, for example, we went the way that it was looking like, the former government was going to go, which definitely is not something that most young people who I speak to are super keen on, which is the notion of having some kind of artificial intelligence or website tell you what to do if you're experiencing mental distress.
Certainly. Do you think that New Zealand has had a culturally appropriate mental health service for youth in recent years?
Absolutely not. And I think that that's reflected particularly in the absolutely abysmal suicide statistics that were released yesterday by the Chief Coroner. The fact that we have a gross overrepresentation of particularly Māori and young Māori men in particular in those figures is demonstrative of the fact that our system is failing. But I would say broader than that, there's been an ongoing discussion, and I was part of negotiating the government's response to the Mental Health and Addiction Inquiry and therefore, the very vexed issue of whether we have a suicide target. And I absolutely stand behind the fact that I believe that if we were to commit to something like that, then it would simply be saying that we were okay with this bandwidth of people taking their lives. One life is too many. So I'm uncomfortable as well with discussing the notion of what proportion of people from different backgrounds or ethnicities we would be comfortable with making up that figure. But to move forward in the conversation, I think we also have to realise that what we're looking at when we're talking about people who are reaching out for help and who are experiencing mental distress, particularly at the severe end, not just the mild to moderate, is that this epidemic didn't come out of nowhere and it didn't occur in a vacuum. We have a huge amount of systemic problems that we have to address in terms of the pipeline that is producing this mental health epidemic. And we know from the likes of the Mental Health and Addiction Inquiry, Hi Ara Oranga, the one facilitated, or started rather, by the government in the first 100 days that we were in office, which received over 5,000 submissions from mental health, drug and alcohol addiction workers, from those who have been through the system and their whānau and friends, is that the major drivers of mental ill health, not just in this country, but it's reflective in the contemporary research internationally as well, are isolation and trauma. Even if somebody has underlying predisposition biologically to experience mental ill health, the environment that one lives in can either exacerbate or minimise the potential for the manifestation of those mental health issues. So what I'm talking about there are the prevalence of issues like poverty, for example, insecurity of housing, insecurity of work, the insecurity of one's future, the inability to connect with others because you're moving all the time. So all of those things, as we know, have far too often become a feature of everyday New Zealanders' lives, particularly in big cities like Auckland. And that, I think, is actually where we will start to address the core root of the problem, but that is a big-time fundamental shift in the conversation about mental ill health. It's not just treating those symptoms as they are expressed, but it's going right back to the start and ensuring that people have security in terms of their daily lives.
Certainly. Where does the PICU pilot program go next after this?
So we have now completely rolled it out within the Greater Wellington region, which is awesome, and it will service over 10,000 young people. And we have that secured in funding for the next 3 years, so there will be a massive evidence base coming out of it. There are a huge number of variables that are being monitored by the University of Otago, who will be producing regular reports. But ultimately, if I can be very clear on what the Greens are advocating for, is for some of that $1.9 billion of funding, which we obviously advocated for in the budget released a few months ago, to see this rolled out around the rest of the country, if not backing PICU, which is such a deeply integrated web of services, then at the very least backing those services that are serving those with mild to moderate needs, because we know that far too many people are currently reaching out to services that are overstretched.
You mentioned that this was part of the confidence and supply agreement between Labor and the Green Party within the coalition agreements. And obviously this has been a success for more than just the Green Party, but is this something that the Green Party are incredibly happy with so far in their kind of relationship in the coalition?
So we absolutely consider this rollout of the PICU pilot project a really crucial, tangible part of realising the confidence and supply agreement. Notably, the confidence and supply agreement has 20 different commitments therein, one of which is kind of the flagship, was the framework around the notion of wellbeing and shifting away from GDP, which has obviously now been attributed to the wellbeing budget. But what I would say is that it's a good start. I definitely will be very transparent about the fact that this does not go far enough, and I will continue advocating for it to be rolled out across the entire country, because as far as I'm concerned, far too many people are still suffering and not able to access the help that they need when they need it.
That was the Greens' Chloe Swarbrick talking to me this morning about the PICU pilot program, which is a youth mental health program. If you missed that interview or any interviews earlier in the show, you can of course find them on the 95BFM website under the BCasts section.
Thanks very much, Oscar. And to top up that, you can also text us or call us if for any opinions you have on the stories that we have did earlier. And now,
the French, for instance, love the cock.
You're tuned into The Wire.
On International Desk this week, we are going to South America. As you may have known, the Amazon rainforest is facing the worst fires in a decade, as the smoke from the fire has covered more than half of Brazil, and the fallout from it could change the local system and forever and accelerate global climate change. And even though local politics did not start the fire themselves, they have played a huge part in why the fire is the worst in a couple of decades.
Fires engulfing large swaths of the Amazon rainforest. The smoke is traveling far and wide. It darkened the skies over Sao Paulo, which is more than 2,000 kilometers south of the burn area. The scope of the fires is massive. These satellite images from NASA show how the smoke has covered most of the northern half of Brazil, which is larger than the whole of Europe.
Since 3 weeks ago, the Brazilian part of the Amazon rainforest have been engulfed in flames. The Amazon itself is spread across three countries in South America, in Bolivia, Brazil, and Colombia. However, this time, most of the worst affected regions are in the north of Brazil, with the northern states of Roraima, Acre, Rondônia, and Amazonas all saw a large percentage increase in fires when compared with averages across the last 4 years. Forest fires are common in the Amazon during the dry season from July to October, and they can be caused by naturally occurring events such as lightning strikes. It could also be caused by farmers and loggers who are clearing land for crops and grazing. Using fire to clear land for crops, or as known as slash and burn, has been a sustainable farming method for centuries, as Dr. James Milner from Massey University explains.
Slash and burn is an ages-old technique used by many, many countries or cultures in different countries, but often in tropical areas where there's a defined dry season and wet season. And so to grow their crops, they will often cut all the trees and shrubs in a small area of the forest. And after it's been lying there for most of the dry season, they'll set fire to it. And the fire does a number of things. It kills any existing vegetation, and it releases a lot of nutrients that are tied up in the vegetation that's been cut. So you get a temporary lift in fertility, which is great for growing crops. And so they'll grow crops for 3, 4, 5 years, but almost without exception, crop yields start to fall away and they move on, and they'll go to somewhere else in the forest and just repeat that over and over and over again. Now, that system was sustainable in most situations because you had a stable population and they were only cutting very small areas in the forest, and the forest would regenerate. So it might take hundreds or even thousands of years before, you know, that area would be cut again. So it was self-sustaining. It was a sustainable way of living.
However, Dr. Milner also said the slash and burn method in today's Brazil is not sustainable at all.
Now, what you've got in Brazil at the moment is, if you like, shifting agriculture on an industrial scale. So, you know, the slash and burn thing has greatly increased, and unlike traditional or indigenous slash and burn, you've got industrialization. So the ground is then developed for agriculture, either pasture for cattle or crops such as soybeans. And so there's no regeneration. It's resulting in permanent removal of forest into some form of permanent agriculture.
And Brazil's current economy before the fire is not helping the Amazon. The Brazilian GDP, since the recession in 2015-16, had contracted by 7%, and recovery has been sluggish. Unemployment remains high, and the Brazilian real has almost halved against the US dollar. And that's how current President Jair Bolsonaro stepped in.
On the environment, Bolsonaro had suggested pulling Brazil out of the Paris Climate Agreement, though he later backtracked on the idea. Calling conservation efforts a threat to Brazilian sovereignty, Bolsonaro has pledged to allow agricultural and mining companies to exploit indigenous land.
It represents a vision of the environment of maybe 50, 100 years ago, or even before that, of the 19th century, as though we had to conquer the territory, instead of looking at the environment as an asset.
Bolsonaro has also promised to abolish the Ministry of Environment. In terms of economic policy, though he's admitted to ignorance about the economy, Bolsonaro champions a liberal economic agenda. He has promised to lower taxes and support small government. He believes privatizing numerous Brazilian companies would help cut down on corruption.
Prioritizing business interests, Bolsonaro resumed hydro projects in the Amazon that were previously banned on environmental grounds and lowered penalties for environmental crimes. Without these strong penalties, more smaller groups who can benefit from using land at the forest have gone ahead and burned the forest, even if it's illegal, because they know they would not be stopped by the authorities. As a result, according to Greenpeace forest campaigner Juman Kuba, there has been a 145% increase in fires compared to the same period last year.
I think what we've seen is that since Bolsonaro's come into power, there's been an active move to clear more land in order to grow more crops and to generally increase agribusiness. And that's come at the expense of the forests. Earlier this month, there was what was called a day of fire, where farmers along a main road in the Amazon were deliberately setting flame to parts of the forest. And that resulted in a 300% increase of fires in the area. And that kind of activity is part of what we're seeing now, where you've got the National Space Agency showing images of forest destruction across the Amazon and wider forests in Brazil.
International pressure is also piling on Brasilia to properly respond to the crisis. The G7, who held its summit in Biarritz, France, prioritized this issue, and a toast, French President Emmanuel Macron has called the fire an international crisis. But for now, Bolsonaro has called in the Brazilian military to help put out the fire. But it is still unknown when the fire, now burning at many places at once, will be under control. Yes, and we just heard the news that the G7 group, who just concluded their summit in France, has already announced they will allocate $22 million in funds to help Brazil to provide logistical and financial support to fight fires in the Amazon rainforest. But some of the EU member states, such as Ireland, France and Finland, have threatened to veto a trade deal with Brazil if it does not handle the fire properly. So this trade deal is between EU and couple of South American states such as Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Uruguay, and it abolishes tariffs, making it easier to export goods to Europe and South America, and vice versa. Now, because under the EU, each trade deal will need to be ratified by every member state individually to make it in force, if these three countries, France, Ireland, and Finland, veto the trade deal, the trade deal will not go through, and Brazil basically will be dragging its fellow neighbors down into a financial hole. You're on 95 BFM, and that was International Desk, which we talked about the Amazon rainforest the fires at the Amazon rainforest. We'll be back after a quick break.
In the market for a cleaner, healthier home? Craft Homes is your first choice. They work with you from design to project completion for a home that's minimum impact, maximum efficiency. Building Homestar 6 homes through to Passive House standard, Craft Homes are smarter, more energy efficient, and built from sustainable and environmentally friendly products. Don't just build a home, build a more sustainable future. Craft Homes. Homestar approved practitioners. Go to crafthomes.co.nz.
The 2019 Monster Energy Jossie Wells Invitational. Like nothing else on the world circuit, the best skiers and snowboarders from around the globe picked by New Zealand's own Jossie Wells. 3 days of competition, three different disciplines, all rider judged, and with one hell of a party to finish it off. Fully sick and unmissable, the FOMO is real. The Monster Energy Jossie Wells Invitational, September 9 to the 15th. Go to cadrona.com/JW Invitational.
Bon Iver's new album, I, is out this Friday. It's got collabs with the likes of James Blake and Moses Sumney, and we reckon it's flippin' ace.
For only take a stand and take it where you are.
That's why it's our album of the week.
Full time, you talk your money up.
If you want to get your hands on a copy, then just grab your B-card and stay tuned to 95 BFM all this week for your chance to win. Bon Iver, I, out Friday, wherever fine music is sold.
The Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
And finally for today, DeRay McKesson is one of the leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement. He is also known for his work to end police violence, founding the Campaign Zero police reform movement. Recently, he wrote a book called On the Other Side of Freedom, and he is in New Zealand at the moment for events with TEDx Christchurch, World Christchurch and Verb Wellington, which is happening tonight. Our news director, Lillian Henley, got to speak with him before these events, and they had a conversation about the power of naming and defining, the commercialization of activism and hope. The full conversation will be online at 95bfm.com/bcast, but here is an excerpt, and Lillian starts by asking DeRay to introduce himself.
Yeah, my name is DeRay McKesson. I'm an activist. I was one of the original protesters in the street in St. Louis 5 years ago when the police killed a teenager, Michael Brown Jr., and I continue to do this work. I'm a black man, a gay black man who lives in Baltimore.
Can you just give us a bit of an idea of, I mean, I guess extending on that, what do you do? What's your day-to-day and sort of what brings you here to Aotearoa?
Well, I'm here now because I wrote a book and am talking about the book and the issues related to justice. But day-to-day, I still focus almost exclusively on issues of policing. Like, that is like what I do. So, you know, in America, a third of all the people killed by strangers killed by a police officer. This is the first year ever where black people are more afraid of being killed by a police officer and being killed by community violence. So I'm part of a team of people, and we work to uncover the laws, policies, and practices that almost guarantee that the police won't be held accountable, because we think that's not okay.
I mean, you've done quite a lot in your life and in the past few years, especially, and I wanted to touch on Campaign Zero, which is something you're working on more recently. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so it started with this idea, right, that we can live in a world where the police don't kill people. We can get to zero. And it started, the first project we did was mapping police violence. So we were trying to figure out what's the data, what are the numbers? Because people were like, you know, we don't know what the numbers are, da-da-da. And we were like, let's figure out what the numbers are. And then we went into policy and laws. So we maintain the most comprehensive database of use of force policies in the country, and then the most comprehensive database of laws that protect the police, and we work with cities and states to change those. So there are 18,000 police departments in the country, which is a lot, and most of the change that will actually be helpful to people's lives will happen at the local level.
I'm going to get back to your book, but I'm going to kind of go into some questions around definitions and names. How important is it to you that people are able to name or define themselves?
It's, you know, we think about definition as the first act of power, right? Like how we talk about the world shapes the way that people interact in the world. So what we say about young people often is that they have the experiences before they have the language. So we know that in some people, especially young people, we're helping them develop the language to talk about the world around them, but we honor the fact that they have the experience. And with adults, we are helping to empower them to describe the world that they live in today, and more importantly, describe the world they think they should live in the future.
And in terms of the defining being a power, or naming being a power as well, it's a process that affects certain people disproportionately. So how do we redistribute that pressure of being named or naming and defining?
Yeah, I think that we take it, right? I think that, like, one of the things that I've learned in the past 3 years is that we take for granted how much naming matters, that like we've always called it this thing. So of course it's like, I think that that is sort of a normal thing. I think that what we've seen people, especially in indigenous communities and people of color, do is just name things the way they want it to be named, right? I think that kids' names are one of the best examples, is that like you go, especially in the black communities at home, it's like there are all these names that people are like, that's a crazy name. Why would you name a kid that? And then so many ways it is people saying, like, I get to choose this name, and I'm going to make sure that the name means something in a way I want it to mean, not just for dominant culture. And then the other is to push back on the way definitions function today. So, you know, I'm always mindful to tell people, like, accountability and justice sound similar, but they're not the same, right? Accountability is what happens after the trauma. Justice is the idea that people shouldn't have to experience the trauma in the first place.
I'm interested in your definition of activism or an activist. How would you define that?
Yeah, this is one of those things that I'm not actually, I worry sometimes that we put people in a box. But what I would say is that, like, somebody who identifies as an activist is somebody who believes that taking action is a way to change the outcomes and has a track record of doing that. But I also know there are a lot of people who don't identify as activists who are really committed to doing the work of change, and I'm okay with that too, right? That, like, it actually doesn't have to be an identity for you to be able to do the work.
And because you've also said that there's sort of no one way to do that work.
Absolutely, yeah. If there was one way, we would have, like, we'd know, you know?
Mm.
If there's one way, we would have fixed all the problems already, and Lord knows we've not done that.
Yeah. Can I get your thoughts on this idea of, I mean, we can maybe call it perhaps Instagram activism, or the glamour that comes with, or fashion that, you know, it is to be able, or to be woke these days. So how detrimental is that commercializing, I suppose, of a movement?
Yeah, I think that the, with the good part, I'll say, is that, you know, it is important that as many people are involved as they can be, right? So, like, I think that what you call the commercialization, I think that it has created an entrance for people where they feel like, you know what, I can go do this. I can go shut that down, or I can sit here, or, like, whatever. I think that's good. I think the danger comes when people think that activism is something that you just sort of sporadically do for 10 minutes and then you pop out, or when people take a stand or seem to take a stand only because they want the attention that comes, right? And what you find with those people is that the moment that it gets hard, they're unwilling to do anything, right? That they are, like, not there for the battle. They just are there for the glory. I think that that's dangerous. But I'm mindful, you know, when people used to say about us, like, we're Twitter activists, and it's like Twitter is the only reason why we're talking about any of this stuff in the first place, mm-hmm. right? If it wasn't for Twitter, we wouldn't be having this conversation about justice. We wouldn't be having this conversation about the police. that we tried to do it your way, the old way. We did it the, we went to all the meetings, we called everybody, we did that, and it didn't work. But it was Twitter and our bodies in the street that actually allowed us to do something that nobody's done before. So I never criticize it too much because I saw firsthand how it changed our lives.
And I want to come back to that sort of tool, but I also want to mention, because you used to be a teacher, and teaching isn't necessarily glamorous or Instagram worthy, but it's incredibly important. So how do you ensure that all those roles necessary in creating true systemic change are supported?
Yeah, I think that some of it is letting go of the need for control, right? That, like, I think there's one way to think about activism that says, because I've done it long, and this is what we faced when we were in the street. There were a lot of people who said, I've done it longer, therefore I know more, right? And we were like, well, you actually haven't done it here, and you haven't done it this way. So I think that we can actually learn from each other, but I don't think it's like, you have done it longer, therefore you know. And then we also push up against the people who say, I've studied history, therefore I know the future, right? And there are a lot of, like, that's a lot of historians are like, well, I've studied this for 20, 30 years. And it's like, well, yeah, you studied the decisions somebody else made. You didn't actually make the decisions, right? Like, you don't know how it was. So I say all that to say that, like, some of my growth in learning about in the protest has been, like, giving up the control to need to define the way other people act in this space. The only times that I intervene now are when I think people are doing legitimate harm, right? Mm. There are a lot of places where, like, I disagree with the tactics. I'm like, well, I wouldn't have done it like that, or I don't think that was the best way to do it. But I own that, like, that's what people said about us. People told us to get out of the street, right? People told us that, like, we shouldn't go to this meeting, or we should go to this meeting, or, and we did what we thought was right, and, like, people should do what they think is right. I think that we all have a responsibility to intervene when we think people are doing damage.
Mm-hmm. And I guess on that too, the sort of definition of organizing or creating, I guess, in a way, a movement, but where does organizing actually start?
Yeah, well, I think that all the ideas that have ever changed the world have always started in one of four places, right? Probably like a porch, a kitchen, a basement, or a classroom, right? Like, most of the best ideas happen in those spaces. But when I think about what is organizing is like helping people find their power and then expand that power. Like, that's what activists say, like, go do this thing, right? They're like, come here, come shut this down, let me help you do that. Organizing is about building the capacity of people around you so that they can build the capacity of people around them. Organizing is about multiplying power and expanding power. Activism is about channeling power.
And how important are relationships as part of that?
Yeah, there's no movement without the relationships. The strength of everything we have is actually because of relationships, especially because, like, the movements today have not grown out of sort of hierarchical structures, right? It's not like everybody's a member of this club at school called the Movement Club. And then they go, you know, like, people come out and they sort of form a relationship. And I don't know how a movement lives without those deep relationships. So I will say what was hard for us in the street is that we learned each other because of the trauma we were facing together. We had to learn each other outside of the trauma later. So there were so many people who, like, we'd never really had a conversation, but I've been with them for 400 days. We've been in some of the craziest situations we've ever been in our lives, but, like, we didn't know anything about each other's families or each other's lives. Like, we actually had to do that learning on the back.
That was The Wire.
That's indeed The Wire for today. Thanks to my producers, Mitch, Oscar, and of course our news director, Lillian Henley. And thanks to those who talked to us today, we had a lot of people. David Parker, Chloe Swarbrick, Andrew King, Dr. James Milner, and Deray McKesson. Up next, it's the 1-2-4 with Jim. Thanks for your company, and I'll see you next time.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.